We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut. Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday once again, the 13th of July, in the glorious future year of 2024. And this is your regularly scheduled Publius coming at you again with a rough and ready pre-recorded show, because I need to go out to Louisville in order to pick up my badge for Anime Fest, which is at the end of the month. I will have a table there. Just got confirmation on that. So if Arlington, Texas is someplace you might be the last weekend of this month, you could potentially drop in and see what I'm doing and talk to me. Also, 1 month from today, well, the 13th of August, which is a Tuesday, not a Saturday, just after the end of the World Science Fiction Convention in Glasgow, I am going on a tour of the nuclear power station at Torness, near Dunbar, on the east coast of Scotland. This is, of course, an AGR station, a type of nuclear power station only ever built in Britain, and they are rapidly being taken out of service because of graphite aging. So, not too many more opportunities left to visit one. I love visiting nuclear power stations, and this one is something special. Now, next week, as you will notice, my show falls on the glorious 20th of July, the anniversary of the first human footsteps on a planetary body other than the Earth. Celebrate it. Every year. But we'll talk about that next week when it arises. Although, certainly, I encourage you to get your fireworks and your cookout gear and whatever else you're planning on using for the celebration ready before then. If you are interested in seeing the current state of work on issue number 2 of my publication Blast, head on over to sdf.org/l/20g. That's sdf.org/lima/20golf. I'm sorry to say I haven't been to the post office since Monday, so if there is any mail that has been sent to me recently, I haven't picked it up yet. We will have to defer mail call until next week, I'm afraid. At last notice, there were over 1 million people still without electric power in the Houston, Texas area as a result of Hurricane Beryl. Now, as I've said in the past, satellite observations of weather systems greatly reduce the damage that comes from hurricanes, for a number of reasons. Firstly, just being warned means that you can board up your windows or evacuate or whatever. It also allows people in charge of various functions, such as power supply and water pumping, to take necessary protective measures. So why are there still 1 million people without power in Houston? I'm afraid that the answer is the same as it is everywhere in the United States, almost. And that is the continued decay of infrastructure, right? Now, the proximate reason is simply that there are lots and lots of above-ground power lines in the Houston area. Houston being caught sort of between two fires here, because on the one hand, overhead power lines are liable to be damaged in a high wind. On the other hand, underground power lines present a certain problem because Houston is swampy, marshy, very wet ground. So transformer vaults and all those kinds of things are very much subject to flooding and all other kinds of damp problems. And obviously, heavy rain that comes with a hurricane and storm surge and similar phenomena are going to put a lot of water into your ground. And so if you are in a marshy area, all the problems that you have day to day are going to be gravely exacerbated. So undergrounding the power lines is not a perfect and total solution to the problem of hurricane damage in the Houston area, although I suspect it would help a great deal. For one thing, you wouldn't have to worry about poles being pushed over and the pole transformers actually, you know, hitting the ground. But just in general, as has repeatedly been pointed out and has been seen in many ways, the United States, in common to a great extent with the other wealthy countries of the world, has an enormous amount of infrastructure and has not invested properly in maintaining it, that our parents and grandparents and, to some extent, great-grandparents' generations built this infrastructure for us, and we've been letting it run down. Not smart. The so-called deregulation of electrical systems is a particular problem because it separates, as I've said before, the billing the customer function from the getting power to the customer function from the generating power function. Now, obviously, the people who bill you are not going to forget to bill you. And they're not going to not pay the people who generate the power, because a shortfall of power on the grid becomes instantaneously a massive problem for everybody. But they are likely to give very little money to the people who actually move the power from the generating plant to your house. Because as the transmission and distribution infrastructure breaks down, it becomes less and less reliable, outages become more frequent and more prolonged, but there's never a sort of catastrophic break the way there would be if there were simply insufficient power on the grid. So it's easy to fall into deferred maintenance and all those other kinds of evil practices, which gradually take you from being a wealthy country in the sense that Adam Smith defined it back in 1776 in his Inquiry into the Origin and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, back into being a poor country again. And I know you may think that renewable energy, wind and solar electricity in particular, are something of a whipping boy for me on this show, but I will point out that they only make this problem worse because they place heavier demands on transmission and distribution. As I've repeatedly said, in a conventional central station power system, where many of the power plants are located reasonably close to the cities they serve, transmission and distribution are frequently 60% or more of the cost of getting a kilowatt hour to the consumer. Now, we know that transmission and distribution costs for wind and solar are at least twice what they are for central station power, even before you begin talking about giant battery banks at substations and that kind of thing. Why? Well, simply because the power sources are located where they're located, not where the cities are, not where the loads are. And, of course, they're spread out, which means that you need to have something that looks like a distribution grid just to gather the power from the various wind and solar sites and bring it together to a substation and put it onto the transmission network. And, of course, the obvious conclusion from that is that even if power from wind and solar were completely free, the cost to the consumer would be greater than in a conventional central station system. And I've said this many times. But you should be able to see the other half right, which is that if the transmission and distribution network is having trouble now, then burdening it even more, requiring even more from it, is going to bring us even more trouble. And people keep talking about doing tens of billions, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars in transmission system upgrades, you're not going to be able to tell me that building nuclear power plants in reasonable proximity to cities isn't the economically superior choice, even before you consider the use of hot water, which I frequently harp on, but again, just envision if large areas of Houston were getting hot water from nuclear power plants and using that to run absorption cycle chillers, then people would not be without air conditioning, even if their power was out. Now, mind you, there is a little problem of how to run the blower fans, but that problem keeps popping up. In the Northeast USA, for example, during blackouts, people often find that they have no heat, even though their heat is gas or oil, because the blower fans for their hot air heating system and the pumps, in many cases, for their oil-fired furnaces require electricity, and there is no local method of providing that electricity. That is a case where a battery backup is not a bad idea. Alternatively, there have been proposals to mount thermoelectric elements on the burners so as to generate the current necessary for the blower fans and the oil pumps and such like appurtenances without which the burner itself isn't all that useful. Let's see. In other news, the Boeing CST-100, or Starliner, is still up at the International Space Station. There is still no announcement on when it will deorbit and come back to Earth, or whether the astronauts who went up to the ISS with it will come back in it, or will be coming down at a later date in a SpaceX capsule. In other space news, France has launched the first Ariane 6 expendable launch vehicle from Kourou, Guyana. The Ariane 6 is frankly baffling to a lot of people because it is a completely expendable launch vehicle with a liquid fuel core and strap-on solid rocket boosters. It has two configurations, one with two strap-ons, which can take 10.5 tons to low Earth orbit or 4.5 tons to a geosynchronous transfer orbit, and one with four solid boosters, which can take 20 tons to low Earth orbit, or as much as 12 tons into geosynchronous transfer orbit. And they say that their order book is full. They're planning 10 to 12 launches a year for the next few years. But it's very difficult to see how they can achieve costs which are comparable to the costs that SpaceX has, and therefore how they can achieve prices that are comparable to SpaceX's pricing, when they're still throwing away their whole rocket on every launch. Currently, I think what they're banking on is two things. Firstly, vendor diversity. In other words, you don't necessarily want to commit all of your satellites to SpaceX, in case something bad happens with them. And secondly, perhaps, they're hoping that SpaceX will get so tangled up with the Starship development program that it will provide more opportunities for other launch service vendors because the Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy will cease to be their main priority. And, you know, that's perfectly credible. I can certainly see that happening. An interesting piece of news from Finland, and this has to be read in context. The Wall Street Journal has been running articles about how lithium mines and now even nickel mines are being idled because of global gluts of those commodities and a sharp fall in prices, simply because the miners have been expanding production, expecting very large uptake in the manufacture of lithium-ion batteries for all kinds of mobile devices, but particularly for battery electric vehicles, which require lots and lots of battery capacity compared to your laptop or your mobile phone. Well, as everybody by now knows, the market uptake of battery electric vehicles has not been as rapid as initially predicted. Now, What will happen a few years out is an interesting question, particularly as there are countries whose official policy, at least as of now, is to ban the sale of new combustion-powered automobiles. We shall see. But for now, there is a glut in the market of both lithium and nickel. Although, given the big scandal with the deliveries of nickel ingots that turned out to be something completely different and spray-painted, I wonder how much of that glut is truly real. There may be some serious skullduggery going on in the metals markets. All that to one side notwithstanding, up in the north of Finland, one mining enterprise has come up with an interesting solution. The Sotkamo mine in Finland produces nickel and zinc by bio-leaching, which is a very interesting process all by itself. And some years ago, they realized that the tailings, or residues, from their nickel-zinc operation contained a substantial amount of uranium. And so they applied to the Finnish government for a license to extract that uranium as a byproduct from what are otherwise mining wastes. And they have now received the necessary go-ahead and are planning on bringing that process up and beginning production in the coming few months. You know, I've mentioned before the possibility of things like recovering uranium from the ash at coal-fired power plants. And of course, for many years, going back to the 1940s, uranium has been recovered from gold mining residues in South Africa. But at the moment, this makes Finland the only uranium-producing country in the European Union. I suppose France has largely shut down domestic uranium mining, although, of course, they were doing that in the 70s and 80s. And if you go to my Tubnix channel, you can actually see a video of uranium mining and refining in France back in the 60s. Germany did have uranium mining at one time, but mostly in East Germany, and that was all shut down during reunification. Some mine projects that were explored in Western Germany never really got the chance to start up. Similarly, the uranium mining in what had been Czechoslovakia, is now the Czech Republic, was shut down basically about the time the Soviet Union collapsed. Whether there's a case for primary uranium mining in the EU is one question, but when you have this opportunity to get uranium as a byproduct, it's only reasonable to take it. And of course, I should say that the north of Finland is an area very much like the Canadian Shield. So if our listener, some dude up there in Flin Flon, Manitoba, is listening, he knows exactly what kind of country I'm talking about. Finland is mostly rocks and trees, so it makes sense for them to develop their mining industries alongside industries like lumber and paper pulp. They have not, however, let themselves be beguiled into believing that they have a future as a biomass fuel producer. If you're in the U.S., you may have heard some things recently about strange decisions which came out at the end of the last Supreme Court term. Normally, this isn't the sort of thing I talk about on this show, but there is an aspect that I want to bring to your attention, and that is the end of something known as Chevron deference. Now, Chevron deference was a legal doctrine which came out of a case, Chevron USA versus Natural Resources Defense Council, which is cited as 468 U.S. 837, 1984, for those of you who want to pull it up on the LexisNexis database or something. Now, what Chevron deference did was say that where an administrative agency had made policy to fill in the gaps left by an act of Congress, that judges should not try to substitute their own judgment for that of the administrative agency. And this is kind of a necessary provision, because when Congress makes laws, it generally makes them in fairly general terms, stating an objective and giving a rough outline of how that objective is to be pursued. It doesn't get down into the details, generally speaking, because congressmen don't really know about these things. If it does get down into details, in many cases, the details are written by lobbyists, which is perhaps not the best thing. But there is a general tendency for Congress to write reasonably broad legislation and then hand that off to the administrative agencies, who then figure out how they're going to implement it and create the specifics themselves. And this works reasonably well. What the Supreme Court has now said is, no, we are not going to defer to the administrative agencies. We are not going to defer to the professionals who have some understanding of this topic. Instead, we're just going to make it up as we go along. And this is pretty obviously problematic. Having judges whose expertise is essentially in the law and to some extent in conciliating diverging viewpoints try to make rules for administrative purposes in place of the rules made by people whose day-to-day job is doing the actual administration and who therefore have to make the rules work. One of the things that this is very likely to do is to completely foreclose on further nuclear power development in the United States. Because, essentially, what it says is that from now on, anybody can bring a challenge to an action of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't get the benefit of the doubt. Instead, the court will decide not only whether the Nuclear Regulatory Commission acted properly and followed its own rules, but whether those rules are right. The court will now decide on the scientific and technical aspects, and so on. What this basically does is to open the door for any yammerhead out there to tie up any administrative action of the United States government pretty much forever if he can find a sympathetic judge. And what we've seen is that nuclear energy projects are already far too tied up in administrative back and forth. You know, I've often expressed my disdain for the way the Nuclear Regulatory Commission goes about things, but at least their objective is to go about them. Their objective is not to stall everything forever, and their objective is not to make a lot of noise while achieving nothing. So the end of Chevron deference is kind of a big deal, and I think people are underestimating the impact it's going to have. Let's see. Great big item in the Wall Street Journal the other day about how motivational speaker Tony Robbins invested $200 million in a project in West Virginia, which claims that it's going to make clean hydrogen from coal. How? Well, the Wall Street Journal doesn't go into great technical detail. That's not really their thing. But it appears from the description that the plan is to vaporize some 6 million tons of coal a year, precipitate out the carbon as ultra-high purity graphite, leave the rest of the minerals, the ash, behind somewhere, and take the few percent of hydrogen that's contained in ordinary coal and burn it in what used to be a coal-fired power plant. And all of this is proposed as a way to provide clean energy while protecting jobs in the fossil fuel sector. Now, considering that the temperature required to vaporize graphite is higher than the temperature which would vaporize any other engineering material, this seems like a pretty difficult thing to accomplish. And I am reminded of the old saying that you can't cheat an honest man. In other words, that most kinds of fraud assume the complicity of the person being defrauded. And I think, well, there's nobody better to rope into a fraudulent scheme than a professional motivational speaker. I mean, the guy's whole business card basically says con man, right? Professional motivational speaker, Tony Robbins. And the impression that this is all a really big fraud certainly is not reduced by the fact that the inventor of the process, Simon Hodson, described as a white-haired California scientist with a background in cement and food packaging, refers to his process as quantum reforming. Just in general, most of the time you don't want to trust someone who uses the word quantum without a very good justification. Apparently, Hodson had a reasonably effective technology for taking slack coal, coal mining waste, essentially, comprised of coal mixed up with non-flammable rock and similar materials, and using it to make cement and agricultural fertilizers. And that at least is reasonable. But vaporizing 6 million tons of coal a year in order to recover the hydrogen? Of course, with all that high-purity graphite as a byproduct, he was also claiming that it would revolutionize every industry to have this giant supply of graphite. The whole thing baffles me, really, but again, there seems to be an enormous enthusiasm for anything in the energy sector that's not nuclear power. People will buy into anything if it means not going nuclear. And to me, that's just madness. Of course, then we have environmental journalist Bill McKibben cheering about, "We've got the fossil fuel industry on the back foot. California is demonstrating that you can run a modern economy with clean energy sources." Bill McKibben, bluntly put, can go to hell. He made his career about 1980, publishing completely bogus stories about the terrible effects of Three Mile Island. He went all around the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area looking for anybody who had unusual health problems or anything like that, and then wrote these articles for publications like Mother Jones, Mother Earth News, and so on, claiming or insinuating that there was some connection between them and Three Mile Island, even though the actual release of radioactive material from the stricken reactor, Three Mile Island Unit 2, was negligible. The effects he attributed to it were effects that couldn't possibly have been the result of even a much larger radioactive release. But that didn't matter, because in the anti-nuclear sphere, facts don't matter. And that's not me saying it, right? That was the anti-nuclear campaigner saying it to me, saying those may be the facts, but the facts don't matter. So yeah, Bill McKibben has been, passively, one of the fossil fuel industry's biggest cheerleaders because of his continuing efforts to blacken the name of nuclear energy to interfere with the development of nuclear energy. He's one to talk. No, if you want to see a modern economy powered by clean energy, you want to look at France, not California. Let's just hope that France can retain its position. The downside of the recent victory of the left in the French elections is that the French left has a lot of the Greens, the so-called écolos, who are very anti-nuclear, and they don't care that nuclear energy has been successful. Indeed, I'm told that some of their leaders have recently been saying, "We'd better soft-pedal all this talk about climate change because it makes nuclear sound good." Anyhow, you have been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I will probably read them out on the show. I'll probably send you something in return. If you like these broadcasts enough to support them and are not comfortable mailing me wads of cash, paypal.me/prometheuslives, patreon.com/man_and_atom. Don't forget my other show, Hear Now the Words, on Anon Radio at 15 UTC every Tuesday and Friday. And now, here's Tobe with the Dubious Goals Committee, which airs every day at 1930 UTC on AnonRadio.net.
7, 6,